Hey everybody, welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 40. Oh, the Nerdist Podcast turns 40. It's time for some kind of weird midlife podcast crisis where we try to finger a 19-year-old girl in a Trans Am. They still make Trans Ams? Doesn't matter though, because here's some stuff that I want to throw at your ears. First of all, I would like to thank the group Fifth Engine who donated this wonderful music bed. The song is called Collapse, and they are available online. The web. Same place you got this thing, probably. Also, former Nerdist Podcast guest Scott Sigler, author, New York Times best-selling novelist, has a limited edition hardcover of The Rookie. And The Rookie's Rookie's an alien sports book, so it's kind of a cross between Any Given Sunday and Deep Space Nine and The Godfather. If you go to scottsigler.com/The Rookie and use the coupon code Nerdist, you will get $3 off the cover price. You can't get it in stores. So get your copy today at scottsigler.com/The Rookie. Also, I will be telling jokes at the Brea Improv October 21st to 24th. If you don't know what part of California Brea is in, you probably weren't going to go anyway. It is south of Los Angeles by a ways. Also, I'll be doing shows in Atlanta, Georgia and Addison, Texas in November. So if you want to be on the promotional street teams for those, just shoot me an email at stuff@nerdist.com. And then the subject line, pick me in whichever one of those cities you're in. All right, so this podcast, Jonah Ray and I stormed Mike Birbigs in his hotel room in Hollywood while he was in town for a couple days doing a show. Matt Myra, unfortunately, could not be there because he had to be at work fixing computers where people, like, spill stuff on their laptop and they're like, I don't know what happened. And then he's like, you spilled a drink on this. And they're like, yes. So he was doing that and couldn't be here at the podcast recording. But Birbigs is a great guy, super funny, incredible work ethic, and we'll get more into that in the podcast. So that is it, the Nerdist Podcast number 40 with Mike Birbiglia. Often requested by you guys, so now you can shut up about it. I love you.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
East on Sunset, you'll find.
It's unfortunate because I have to stay in really comfortable hotels because I have a serious sleep disorder, and so it's really important for me
to be able to sleep,
feel relaxed. Yeah. I mean, truly, you know, because it can be dangerous, and maybe that's just an excuse for me to put myself up in really nice hotels.
Where have you stayed before?
Well, I've stayed at the Roosevelt, which is even douchier.
Yeah.
Oh, is it the Roosevelt just down the road?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, like, they have the whole pool area. I know how douchey it can be because I have a friend that does DJ nights there.
Well, I'll tell you how douchey it is. They shot an episode of Entourage.
Yes.
There. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's so this entire area.
It's official.
Yeah. That's the stamp.
They got the mayoral stamp.
That's the stamp.
Douche.
That's like getting the government thing that says historical landmark. That's if they shot an Entourage episode there, you get the douche landmark.
The worst, though, is when, I'll watch an episode. I watch every episode. I don't know why, but I'll watch every episode and see in a place that I like to go, and then they're shooting there, and I just go, oh
man,
I guess I can't go there anymore.
That place used to be cool.
It used to be cool, man.
I'm so bewildered by Entourage, you know, because it's like, I believe it's well written in a traditional sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's got some funny parts and some rich characters. I mean, I particularly like the brother character.
Oh yeah, Johnny Drama.
Yeah, it's just like so real.
That's the thing. So that's why vivid. I think I like it, because it's I find myself forgetting that these guys aren't actually these guys.
Yeah,
that's
but
because they are.
That's my problem with it though. It's just like I hate hanging out with those people in life.
That's right.
So I don't want to hang out with them in my living room.
That's right.
But I will say I'm very happy about this. Is that when I was a teenager, maybe I was like 20. I was 20 years old, 21. And I was dating this girl, and she was an actress, and she was in this group of kids who were all like smarmy actor kids. And like when I think back of it now, it's crazy because it was like Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire and this guy named Jay Ferguson who's on Mad Men now.
How old were you at the time?
21 maybe.
Holy
and then and Kevin Connolly. And I always remember Kevin being like, Kevin was such a cool dude. And, you know, everyone else kind of popped before he did, even though he did that on Happily Ever After show for a while. Oh. But I'm so glad that he finally, like, popped on a show, because he's such a good dude. And it just always makes me happy when, like, good dudes score. Like, that makes me very happy. I hope he's... Yeah. I hope he's...
You should write that book. Swimming you should write that book, When Good Dudes
when
good Score. Dudes,
when yeah. Good Dudes Score.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you'll make a bunch of money off it, because a bunch of guys who are into sports will buy it. Yeah, I think it's just about their favorite football.
But it's really just about the philosophy of being a good person and achieving things in life.
Finally, something works out for a good-looking white guy.
Oh, I mean, it's about time.
It's heartwarming when that happens.
Well, you know, we had a struggle for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
We had a struggle that legally we couldn't do a lot of things.
Hundreds of years of strife.
Held down by minorities. And we finally broken free to become actors.
It's funny that you guys can joke around about that, but growing up white, I did have some struggles.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in Hawaii.
Oh.
And so I did have, like, racial struggles to deal with.
The local clientele.
Yeah, Jonah's a Portuguese guy who's white who grew up in Hawaii. He had a very interesting background.
Yeah, but, like, it's like, so, like, it's funny because one time I got into an argument with a guy who was saying, it was this kind of Latino guy out here saying, you don't know what it's like, man. You don't know what it's like growing up like I did.
Yeah.
I said, well, you're Latino and you grew up in Southern California. I'm white and I grew up in Hawaii. I think... maybe a little bit more.
Yeah.
Maybe I had less places I could go than you.
I think the Latino guy didn't get beaten up by Samoans all the time. I think you actually might have had it a little bit worse.
Yes, probably. Yeah.
but to get back to Entourage, I think it's well written. I think it's well acted, particularly in some areas more than others.
Right.
But I just feel like it's culturally kind of irresponsible in the sense that I think people see it. And I talk to people, and they go, that's what I want to do. And you're like, no, that's a joke. It's a joke that those are the losers.
You know what, though?
Who you don't want to be.
It's that thing, and it's interesting. And I think it's part of the reason. I think it was one of the things that flipped out Chappelle when he was doing Chappelle's show. He was
like,
oh fuck. No, the wrong people are laughing at this stuff for the wrong reason. This isn't supposed to make racists laugh. This is supposed to make fun of that. And I had
that happen once when I don't know if you've ever heard, I do a joke about white people using the word cracker on stage.
Yeah.
And I liked the bit a lot. I did it for a lot of years. I did one of my specials. But one time this guy came up to me after a show in Cincinnati, and he was like, I'm with you, man. And I was just like, oh, okay. what do you mean? And he lifts up his shirt. And he has a swastika tattoo.
No.
I go, no, I'm not with you. We're not together at all.
The same.
Well, I don't even know. Yeah, but I think that's inevitable. I think that, you know...
You can't pick your fans.
Yeah, someone could read Uncle Tom's Cabin and just go like... Yeah.
Well, I think it's
fuck those people.
It's like, if you look at like the Man Show, you know, when they started that show, it was like... We are going, you know, like, they're going to make fun of, like, douchey, ridiculous, you know, and then look who ended up being the fans of that, you know, like, the core demographic of that show. We were like, that would be hilarious to have tits that serve beer. Come on! You
know? Yeah.
So it's like,
the same goes with bands, you know. Bands, like, a lot of bigger bands hardly have anything in common with their fans.
Yeah.
You know, just it's like Nirvana hated their fans. For the most part.
No,
Belushi was tormented by people who loved Animal House.
Yeah.
who loved Bluto.
I'm actually really lucky in that sense. Is like I'm one of the few people I actually like my fans, and they're a small group of people, and they're very loyal, and they come whenever I come to their cities, and I always bring a new show, and I like them. Like
that's
when I
good.
Do meet and greets afterwards, I'm like, I like these people.
I feel the same exact way.
Kept coming out for years, and that's. All my career was, I'd be thrilled.
I know most young comics don't think about this, but I think almost as important as, you know, like just kind of finding your voice and figuring out who you are, which isn't as much of a choice, but I think it's very important to figure out who you want your audience to be. I think it's really important to figure that out.
Yeah.
Because then once you do, you can kind of start communicating with them, and then you won't be irritated.
Well, that's
by
what, it. You know, so you've been able to figure out in the past, like, few years, like, you've really figured out who you want to zero in on, and it's, like, really working out for you.
Well, it was more that I just sort of started writing about stuff in a direction of things that I liked,
and
it just attracted people that I would hang out with because I'm, you know, I'm out there shouting, like, these are things I like, and then they're going... We like this stuff too, and I'm like, oh, I would hang out with you.
Yeah,
you know. So
I have to be careful sometimes because with political stuff, like I dabble in political comedy. Like, I literally, I think I have one political bit on each album, and they're very short. Mm-hmm. One of them is about George Bush.
We'll throw hot dogs.
Being like the guy you invite to the barbecue because you know he'll start the wiffle ball game. He's wiffle ball Tony.
Wiffle ball Tony, that's right.
Hey, wiffle ball Tony's here. Yeah. One day somebody's like, we're going to put Tony in charge of everything. And I'm like, we are? I don't know if that's such a good idea. He gets carried away. He starts, you know, like going into the neighbor's lawn, challenging them to wiffle ball games. I do this whole bit. The only reason I wrote that bit, I never wanted to do political comedy. The only reason I wrote it is, I was doing a show in Pittsburgh. It's funny because I later found out that Patton Oswalt had a whole run-in politically in Pittsburgh, too.
Oh, yeah.
Which I didn't know about. But I was doing a show in Pittsburgh, and the guy opening for me, and this was probably 2003, 2004, he was doing all this, like, rah-rah pro-Bush stuff.
He opened for you?
Yeah. Oh, it was just, like, the local guy. And it made me, like, sick that my show had this kind of like rah-rah pro-Bush rally feel to it.
Right.
People cheering. Like, not even jokes. Like, that's the thing is, when you've been a comedian long enough, you realize that, like, you can get people to applaud for almost anything. You have that.
The clap trap.
Is that what you call it?
I call it the clap trap. Yeah, like, when you say something like, but this is the greatest country in the world.
Clap trap. And so he was doing the clap trap stuff, and I was just like, I feel uncomfortable with this. And so I was on the phone with my brother Joe, and I was like, I gotta come up with an anti-Bush bit that's better than his pro-Bush bit. And I go, Joe, what do you think of this? And we started riffing on the phone. I put it on stage, and then it bombed. And then by the end of the week, it was killing. And then that was a bit. But then the thing is like with Twitter, for example, it's so immediate that like the jokes aren't as well sculpted when you write something on Twitter. So it's just out there.
Right.
And so you're really not, it's not honed, it's not thought through. And so with Wiffle Ball Tony, conservatives and liberals actually could both get behind it because it kind of balanced. I carefully honed it over the series of
months. It's also cradled in a context, and Twitter does not provide that.
Exactly. And so I actually had to stop just saying anything political on Twitter because people would just send me hate stuff back, and I was just like, I don't want to be a part of this dialogue.
It's just not worth it.
That's what happens to Jen Kirkman, like, every day.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She'll say something like slightly political, and then it's just a barrage of, you know, people responding, telling her she's a bastard.
She's actually my special guest in Portland, Oregon.
I want to talk to you for a second about Kirkman and then in your kind of comedic writing journey, which is so fascinating to me, and it's a story I tell a lot of people. I think I might have told it on this podcast a couple times by now, but I want to go back and say I think that is the Patton Oswalt story from Pittsburgh you're referring to. Is that the one where he was on stage and he was talking about Hitler and George Bush, and everyone was like, "Boo, get the fuck out of the stage!" And he was like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, you guys, I'm not saying that Hitler is like George Bush." And they're like, "All right." And he goes, "I mean, Hitler was elected." And they're like, "Fuck you!"
Oh my God.
Because they thought they were coming out to see, you know, adorable little Spence from King of Queens, and there's this guy with this vitriolic, you know, anti-Bush stuff.
That's a tough thing, you know. And I even felt that way, you know, very sad thing. Greg Giraldo passed away this week, and I was on the internet, you know, looking everywhere, and it really hurts me when people write in the news, like it's on MSN, like, insult comic Greg Giraldo passes, and I'm like, no, he's a social commentator, and he was just a brilliant, brilliant stand-up comedian, and the roast stuff, it was like, he could do that in his sleep.
Right.
That was something that he could do as like a parlor trick.
Well, he had these. I mean, he had these. You know, if you get
he was amazing on them, but it was like compared to his stand-up, I think nothing. Compared
I mean,
to stand-up.
You know, his stand-ups are these chunks of amazing runs where it's just. I see in my own stuff. You know, I'm definitely influenced by his style.
Oh,
You know, like not giving the audience, you know, like, or at least trying. I don't know if I succeed, but at least trying to not give the audience a break where it's just like, you know, like a constant series of punches to the to the chest.
Yeah, that track he does, Happy Birthday. Do you know that track about the about how in every restaurant people like basically the gist of it is like Americans are so self-centered that, like, you know, when it's your birthday, everybody at the restaurant has to come out and sing a happy birthday. It's like the dishwasher is like, happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you. It's my birthday too, but nobody cares, blah, blah, blah. And it's like this really long run, kind of like what you're describing there. At the end, he goes, how old are you now? There's this whole like political rant that's in the middle of it, and then how old are you now? And it's just like so fucking brilliant. It's like some of his stuff is just like a just like haiku or something, or like a one act play where it's just so perfectly
sculpted. I love Greg, and I actually, you know, I as I've said on the show in the past, you know, I every once in a while I get caught up in a Twitter fight. Someone will say something and it catches me off guard, and I'm, you know, I'm sending them DMs like, what's the deal with that? Most of the time I let it slide. But yesterday, I had just found out about Greg, and I'm not going to say I was best friends with Greg, but I was decent friends with Geraldo, yeah. And I've known him for years. And I always, he's just one of those guys that whenever I would see him, I just genuinely felt like, it's really cool to see you. Like,
me
you're
too.
Such a good guy.
I had the exact same experience.
And so, you know, I sent out a tweet and it said, you know, like, this is fucking awful. And I think he was one of the best comics of our generation. And some fucking guy tweeted back at me, whoa, 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 let's not go too far.
Oh, Jesus.
No.
And I had just found out, and I gotta let this go. And it just, the more I thought about it, the more it just started to slice me in half. And so I sent this guy like 10 DMs. I'm like, who the fuck are, you know, like, what is it? Like, the first things that I wanted to say to him, the first things I typed were, you know, you are a fucking worthless piece of shit human. Yeah. And I thought, well, that's not really the way to go. So I said, look, Greg was my friend. I feel this way about him, and you know, just your comment was really shitty. And the guy wrote back, and he was like, "What the fuck, bro? No one even knew who he was, and no one respected him."
Oh,
what?
God.
So I look at this guy's profile. Now I'm caught up in it, like a fucking idiot. I'm caught up in it. It's this big dumb sack of fucking mayonnaise with a goatee. He's standing on a dock holding a giant fish with his mouth, both of their mouths are agape.
Wow, man, he must be pretty awesome.
And then I see, well, wait till you hear, so in his profile, it's just like, free thinker, Tea Party, Patriots.
I was like,
there you go, there it is. You're fucking slurring out, you know, you're scooping out hatred at people that you know nothing about. Like, who the fuck is this guy to say no one knew Greg? He's the guy, Greg Geraldo was the number one trending topic on Twitter all day. Yeah. Like, and this guy with, you know, no followers is like, no one knew you. And I should have considered the source, but I don't know why, it hurt me in a way that I was not prepared for. I let this guy get to me, and I wrote to him, and I was like, it literally breaks my heart that you would say to someone who just lost a friend of theirs, like, hey, that guy wasn't that great. Like, do you go to eulogies and stand up and go, hey, that lady sucked?
Yeah.
I'm just honest.
You know, you should have just insulted the size of the fish he cut. Then that would have fucking torn him apart.
Yeah.
For days.
Anyway, I felt really stupid about getting all caught up in it, but with the exception of that one piece of shit, there was a tremendous outpouring for Greg. He was just a really terrific guy, and it's really sad.
His dedication to writing always blew me away. I lived in New York for like 2 or 3 months once a while back, and I saw him a bunch of times during that time. And he just every time had a brand new set, which seemed like it was refined beyond, you know.
Yeah.
And even I went online, I was watching clips of him yesterday, and there was one of him on Tough Crowd, where he gets into it with Dennis Leary.
That's a great part where he makes fun of Dennis Leary in the job.
Yeah, exactly. But Dennis Leary kind of calls him out first. Like, he's like, this guy comes with a pocket full of jokes to this show. And he's all, oh, Dennis, actually, that's our job because we're comics. We're comedy writers. And it just turns into, like, Dennis retaliating and, like, and then, you know, like, Greg just insulting him for his show, not being on the air anymore.
The follow-up to that, I think, is Dennis. I'm not sure about this. I think Dennis called Greg. Or send him some kind of note saying, you know, something like apologizing or whatever. Like, it was, I think they actually came to a peace on that.
Oh, that's good.
That's cool. Well, I just hope, and I don't know what the... Does anyone know exactly? I mean, all I keep hearing is that prescription pills were involved, but I don't know exactly what happened.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what happened. I mean, I hadn't stayed in touch with Greg in the last few years, really. I'd run into him about a month ago. My wife and I were walking to a movie and in Manhattan, and we ran into him, and I had just listened to his album Midlife Vices the night before, and just blew my mind. And I was just like, that, I said to him, I was like, this is like your Bigger and Blacker, or this is like your Bring the Pain, like this album is amazing. And Greg's so humble, he's just like, yeah, you know, I just gotta keep going, you know. And yeah, I just think everybody should listen to that album. It is so good. I mean, he was so good at saying, I said this on my Twitter thing, but his comedy, if you look closely at his comedy, it really sticks up for the underdog in a way that is not always done in comedy. That's always what frustrates me in comedy, is when I see, I support almost any stand-up comedy, except when it's somehow kind of bolstering the status quo.
Right.
Is when I get frustrated. And I'm just like, that's not really the point. And it's just kind of easy. And he was, he just had so many bits that this spoke up for the littler guy.
Well, no, and I remember, because, you know, when around the 9/11 time, I lived in New York, and the first comedy I saw after the towers fell was at the Comedy Cellar, and Geraldo was on stage, and he fucking slaughtered, and he took it all, he took the whole thing on, and it was maybe a week or so, I think, I feel like, at the show, and then, because the whole thing was about, like, you know, these terrorists were going to die, and they're going to have 72 virgins, and Geraldo was like, why the fuck do you want 72 virgins? Like, have you ever fucked a virgin before? There's a lot of crying and apologizing. Like, it's terrible. But so he went off on this whole thing about just, you know, like, what fucking idiots they took everyone's lives in the name of. And it was really, and everyone really, like, the audience needed it. They needed it, and they were so into it, and they so appreciated it. Like, rather than, you know, someone just kind of coming up and being like, so the subways are weird, you know. I mean, like, he was definitely a guy who was not afraid to, you know, just sort of go head on.
He took on the truth all the time, you know. He was relentless.
Yeah. More than comics that say they do that, did that, you know.
It's like David O'Doherty said on our show. He's like, you can't say you're controversial. You can't find yourself controversial.
That's right. That's exactly right. So true.
It's like he wasn't the kind of guy who says, like, hey, I'm just speaking the truth here, everybody. I'm just saying what's on everyone's mind. It's like he didn't. He just said it because that was the, you know, it was fact, and it was
He never wrote his own bio and said, this guy's breaking the rules.
He's extreme. He creates the rules and then breaks them.
This guy's taking no prisoners. It's always like a ridiculous concept.
No one's safe. This cat needs to scratch.
Who is taking prisoners in comedy?
I don't know.
Where is this dichotomy between prisoner taking and no prisoner taking in comedy?
I am on the Chris Hardwick prisoner taking tour. All right.
It's all the same crowd for every tour. You just take them along.
You get on stage and then the doors just shut. Okay, you're all my prisoners now. I'm going to take you prisoner.
Does that mean you kill everybody? Is that the idea?
I think you have to kill everyone. Yeah, you have to murder.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
You murder everyone.
So you go on stage and the door is locked, and then you put the gas mask on, and everyone's like, what's going on? And out of the air vents, that yellow
and then you take
Batman
the whole
gas comes out.
Yes, everything goes down.
If you rephrase it, it wouldn't be as popular of a phrase. It'd be like, this guy murders everyone in the audience. Like, oh, no, that's not what I want to be involved with.
Or
at
even
all.
Just if you tweak, this guy imprisons the audience. Entirely different.
This comic believes in the death penalty, so come on out.
This guy's not afraid of torture, so strap yourself in, or he will.
He'll waterboard your funny bone.
Well, so I want to talk a little bit about, I want to talk a lot about you, actually, because you're one of those guys that, you know, like, you're the two examples that I always think of comedians who take on writing. I kind of feel like the way it should be, which is like, well, it's your job. You need to write. It's you and Seinfeld. Like, you and the two guys.
And so, the two of us always get lumped together. And I hate it!
You almost got the Seinfeld show, but then they gave it to Jerry because it's not the same as Seinfeld. But Jen Kirkman
Thank you very much. That's such a huge compliment.
Well, it's always been very inspiring to me because I have difficulty sitting down and writing, like, you know, from a set period of time, and I get sidetracked, and I'm like, no, I don't know what to write down. And a few years ago, Jen Kirkman and I were talking, and she said, yeah, several years back,
good impersonation.
She had Chardonnay and a cigarette and a cigarette holder.
And she's a talent agent from the 50s.
There I was.
All right, me and the bumpins. Put some lipstick on your nipples and smile. So she said, you know, years ago, you had kind of approached her and you're like, we need to get an office, and we need to go to this office, and we need to write every day, because this is our job, and it's important.
Yeah.
And she was like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
And she said, so Mike
that was
went,
that was probably 12 years ago.
Mike went and did it,
10 years
and
ago.
She said your act grew exponentially, you know, as a result of that. So what inspired you to do that, and how did you do it?
Well, I had moved to New York, and I was living in Queens, in Astoria, and in this very small apartment that was shared. And I was, like, temping in the day, and then I was doing shows at night. And often, you know, these shows, you know, it goes till 1, 2, or 3 in the morning. You're like in someone's attic of their apartment. Like,
yes.
You know, like Surf Reality, where it's like, do you ever play Surf Reality in
no.
New York? It's like, oh, man, it's like, I mean, it's essentially like someone's apartment and their chairs around and you're performing for five comics.
Yep.
and you know, it's kind of this pity laughter, and they're laughing at the wrong things on purpose to sabotage you, and you know, and it's just miserable. And then I would go home, and then I would be writing, because after you perform you write more, and
mm-hmm.
and because you're thinking about it, and you're like, I gotta get this idea down for this tag and this and this. And then I'd be up in the morning at my temp job, and I was like, I was going crazy, because I was writing all the time, and I was like, I need to have a separation between my life and my writing. And
mm-hmm.
so I was like, I gotta find like an office, like a shared office or something, and that's where I write. And so it was actually I asked around a few people who I was in touch with, and the person who got back to me and said that she did have an office share was this woman named Colette Burson, who co-created the show Hung.
Oh, I love that show.
With her husband Dimitri Lipkin, and he who was a playwright at the time, and she was a filmmaker, and they just had this office downtown, and it was really like, I don't know, even know how you describe it. I mean, it was just kind of like this relic of an industrial part of town from the 70s, where
mm-hmm.
like they kind of forgot to raise the building, and it was just kind of there, and they kind of barely even knew it was there. It's actually raised now.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, it's just a parking lot now. When they kind of figured it out, but she you know, she said, we're $200 a month, you can have this part of this office, you can have a desk and that kind of thing. So that's what I did. I worked there like every day. That's
and how soon before you started to notice, I mean, there are a couple points I want to hit. Number one, it's kind of like breaking through writing walls, which you must have had to do at some point. And number two, how soon before you started to notice, like, oh, I think this is actually having a tremendous impact on my stand-up.
Well, I still haven't noticed that. I don't think there was a point where it ever felt like it was gelling or anything. It was just what I did,
mm-hmm.
and I always felt like I was behind the eight ball. Like we all feel, you know, you always feel like you're not writing enough, and you're
right.
not producing mm-hmm. enough, and so that, you know, that's how it always felt. But it was actually the idea of it, the kernel of it, came from. My writing mentor in college was this guy named John Glavin, and he was actually the namesake of, this is kind of an obscure piece of trivia, you know, in Memento,
yeah.
The character's name is John G.
Oh!
One of my students in my class was Jonah Nolan, who wrote the short story that became Memento.
All right.
And he named the character John G. in honor of John Glavin. And, and he was just this, he's a, you know, like a Dickens and Shakespeare scholar and just a brilliant, brilliant guy and really giving to students. And he was, he's kind of a drill sergeant in terms of the amount of writing that he demanded of you. I mean, he was the kind of guy who, you know, if you're a minute late for class, you know, don't come to class.
Oh,
you know,
shit.
You'd show up and he would just go, no, no, go home. Go home.
Wow.
No, no, we don't need you here.
He was as bad as Mr. Hand, huh?
Mr. Hand.
Wait, who's that?
Those Fast Times.
Yeah, no, he was, you know, he was that tough, and the amount of writing that you had to do in the class was way more than you could possibly do, but he always taught us that, you know, things that like Woody Allen would say about writing, and other great writers would say, which is that it's in the craft of it and the discipline of it that you become a great writer. It's not in the natural genius of that you're given. I mean, there's a lot of brilliant people, and you know, there's how many people come up to you after shows and they're like, I want to become a comedian.
Oh yeah, always.
The truth is, a lot of them could be great comedians.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even like this thing where they're lunatics. A lot of them are really, really smart, really funny people.
As long as, I mean, like, if you're moderately funny and you have and you're disciplined and you have a good sense of like, this is working, this is not working, you know, I mean, I've gone with jokes where I'm like, I don't really understand why this is funny, but people seem to be enjoying it, and other stuff that I thought was hilarious bombed. And so, you know, I feel like a lot of times, I don't know if I'm the best judge of what's going to be funny or not, but I throw it out there and just kind of, you know, like play the slice. Like if they, you know.
Yeah. I was once like about 2 years into using a joke that I always did well, and then I had this weird couple months where all of a sudden I didn't know why it was funny. And I started.
Yeah. I've had that so many times.
Yeah, just all of a sudden I said it, and then after the show I was like, wait, I don't think it makes sense. But I'd already been saying it. It had already been killing. But I just lost what the meaning was. They were just words at this point.
Yeah.
And then I stopped using it because I just didn't feel... I didn't have the knowledge that...
Have you ever this weird experience where I have jokes that I've started out with and they've done okay, but for whatever reason, the chemistry of my getting more comfortable and confident with them has made them, like, bits that, like, that crush. Like, there's just this weird element of, like, if I'm comfortable and kind of committed to, you know, to it, it just, they connect with it a little bit more, you know, than if I'm pulled back from it and unsure about it.
Well, I think that's actually when a lot of comics who I admire, like, kind of broke through when they got to a point that they're writing so much and they're performing so much that everything that comes through the prism of the Bill Cosby character,
Pryor
character, the Woody Allen character, just is great if you buy into that.
Yeah.
If you buy into them, you buy into everything. I mean, I had that with Stephen Wright. He's the first comic I saw live. And I had that thing where I'm not even able to laugh this hard anymore. but you hear people say this, it's like, I was laughing so hard my stomach hurt.
Yeah.
My mouth hurt, my throat hurt. And I had that when I saw Stephen Wright. Because I bought into it. I was like, oh, I totally get this guy.
Yeah, and it always kind of makes me jealous that I don't have... I think most people do a sort of kind of character of themselves on themselves on stage. But the fact that I don't have that... Stephen Wright was definitely...
Yeah, sure.
Definitely a character.
Although, I've never met him, but people say that he actually is like that.
He kind of is. I talked to him on the phone once, and it was almost maddening, actually, because there'd be these long pauses, and until it was a second past uncomfortable, and then he would start to talk, so I was constantly like... Should I say a thing now?
I ran into him in Vegas once. I didn't know he was performing. I just happened to be at a hotel with some friends, and then I saw him, and I had to tell him that I, you know, enjoyed him so much. And then, like, he ended up talking to me for about 45 minutes, but it was probably about a good 50 minutes worth of conversation. And, like, I kind of figured he wanted to leave, but he, like, just stood there and kept on asking me questions.
Wow.
And he was a very, very nice guy, but very, you know, very slow going.
Definitely.
Yeah, very like, and then asked me if I did comedy. I was just like, well, the sweetest dude, and then gave me passes to a show that night.
Did you go?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was great.
I met Joan Rivers the other night.
Oh, wow.
That was like really moving.
Was
she
nice?
Did you see her movie?
No, I'm dying to see her movie. Everyone says it's great.
Her movie, it's called, I'm forgetting. It's
for some reason I want to say I Want to Be Me, but I know that's not it.
No, and it's the same title as her one woman show that she talks about in the film. But I found the film to be so moving.
I'm looking.
That's what I've heard. Yeah,
and because she's doing a joke about Helen Keller on stage.
Oh my god!
And at a casino in Wisconsin, I think, and this guy goes, "That's not funny." He goes, "I think it's like," he goes, "My daughter's blind, you know, or whatever it wasn't." And she goes, she was like, and I'm paraphrasing because I'm not a tape recorder. she's like, "No, that's why it is funny." She's like, "We talk about things in comedy that we're uncomfortable with. That's what comedy is. So fuck you."
Wow. Oh my god,
that's awesome.
It's a piece of work, isn't it?
A piece
of
work. Yeah. And I started crying.
Oh wow.
It's so powerful.
Yeah.
The piece of film footage, and I told her that, and she was so sweet. I mean, and such an incredible comic still. Like,
you know, it's funny because I saw my parents used to take me. We used to go to Vegas all the time because it's a long story. My dad was a professional bowler, and Vegas is a big bowling town with a lot of bowling conventions. And so I used to go see a lot of shows when I was in Vegas. I saw Steve Martin in Vegas in the 70s.
Wow.
And then
I
did. I saw him do King Tut. It was crazy.
Wow.
And then we saw Johnny Carson and Joan Rivers open for him. And then after the show, like, we saw her in the casino and we stopped and talked to her, and she was so nice and so sweet. And it was so amazing to me because then in the later years, it just, the whole thing with her daughter and the, like, shitting on people's clothes and stuff, it was just like, oh, no, what happened?
It's funny because Eric, the art department guy at Comcast, at E, you know, he's the art department guy for her show now, her E show, Fashion Biz. And he says he's so stoked beyond it because he just watches her, and just in between takes, she just becomes she's just like making jokes with everybody, being like really nice and just joking around with everybody, being hilarious. Everyone's cracking up. Everyone has to settle down between takes because she's making everybody laugh so much.
Nice.
And she's just like the sweetest person.
It's funny. I had a similar reaction over the years. I always saw her like on QVC and on E making fun of people's outfits. And I was always like, I don't know about her. But then you see this movie and you're like, oh my god, she's such a part of comedy history and is such a trailblazer.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you
she
see,
really
you
was.
See her live, you see her live and it really drives that home.
And then you think like, well, you know, she takes these jobs, you know, these fashion police jobs or whatever because she probably gets paid a shitload of money and it's you know, like it allows her to do stand up at a pace she's willing. I always referred to those jobs because I've taken many in my time or it's like the comparison I make is like it's like a vampire who's living on like on a transatlantic ship and he has to eat rats to survive. Like I always think of those jobs as like, this is not my first choice, but I'm just eating this rat so I can survive, so I can get, you know, get to where I need to go. So I'm glad you mentioned that because I got to find that. Maybe I can download that movie.
And she was saying, actually, she recommended to me the movie I Am Comic.
Oh, yeah. Jordan Brady's movie.
Yeah, which she said she loved.
It was phenomenal. I saw it at CineFamily here, and it's great. Jordan did such a great job with it. I'm in it for like 30 seconds, but everyone else who's in it is amazing. Like the whole Rich Scheidner thing is incredible, like his arc.
Yeah.
And then just hearing comics that you love explain, you know, like what, even though some of it is sort of, you know, remedial, it's like, well, a set is made up of chunks, which is, it's still fascinating to watch. It's so great. And, you know, like there's so many great people in it.
Blaine's in that, right? Blaine Patch?
I think he might be.
Yeah.
It's I Am Comic Movie, I think, is the website.
Someone asked me, left me a message when they were shooting that to be in it, but it was just this cold call, and it was just like, if you want to be in this movie, call me back, we're shooting today, or whatever. Okay.
No.
And you get so many phone calls about so many documentaries and so many web series and so many things, you don't know what's what.
And you want to be nice, but at the same time, if you did all of them, you would never have time to do anything else.
Yeah.
But, so, Do you find that when you first started writing 12 years ago, you were kind of writing every day? I feel like when I first started out as a comic, I had tons of shit to write about. Have you found that in these, you know, in this last decade or so, that you still have a lot of shit to write about, or is it sort of some days, is it like,
Yeah, I mean, lately, you know, I did a one-man show called Sleepwalk with Me, mm-hmm. which became, yeah, well, it's so pretentious to say the word titular. It's the titular story.
This is a movie podcast. You can say that, no one will judge you.
Title line.
It's a book of funny stories, and it is one of the chapters of a book of, you know, 14 chapters. The one man show, and the book is called Sleepwalk with Me and Other Painfully True Stories. And Sleepwalk with Me was a one man show that I had worked on probably for about 6 years before we did it off Broadway mm-hmm. last year. And I'd worked on with my director, this guy named Seth Barish, who I had kind of hunted down. Like when I decided I wanted to write a one man show, I saw all the one person shows that were on and off Broadway. I saw I and My Own Wife and Bridge and Tunnel, and this one, which was my favorite, was called The Tricky Part. It was kind of Martin Moran did, and so moving and so funny and just so simple. And I was like, I need to talk to that director. And it was this guy, Seth Barish, who's the artistic director of this theater company in New York called The Barrow Group that puts on tremendous plays. And I kind of stalked him. I mean, I was relentless in terms of, like, trying to convince him to have a meeting with me. And uh-huh. I kind of showed him what I had, sprawled out on a table. Like, here's my comedy CD, and here's the script I wrote, and here's the this. And
this is the flux capacitor, which makes time travel.
And he was... I think the thing that sold him on me was he listened to my self-released CD at the time, which was called Dog Years. Mm-hmm. And he liked... the kind of, I don't know, he said he liked the kind of patience of it, that it wasn't kind of like in your face mm-hmm. comedy. And then we started working together and doing sessions, and then, you know, probably 5 years later or whatever, we do it as a show, and it ran for 8 months in New York. Mm-hmm. And so the new one-man show that I'm working on is opening in New York in late January, early February, you know, assuming that we're all here, and it's hard to plan for the
you
future.
You never know.
That's kind of a morbid way of thinking about it.
Listen, so I'll see you next week.
Well, we'll
maybe.
See.
Yeah.
Hey, you want to have lunch with next week if I don't die? If you don't die?
If.
Okay.
Barring the apocalypse or some unforeseen event, right. I'm going to be doing this new show, which is called My Girlfriend's Boyfriend, and that's my new one-man show. And so I kind of these days I think in terms of shows mm-hmm. Instead of thinking of like joke to joke to joke. It's, mm-hmm. And I'm working on a screenplay adaptation of Sleepwalk with Me.
Oh, nice.
With Ira Glass as one of the producers.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
So
that's what I was working on when you guys showed up. Is I was working on a script for that.
Nice.
Has getting like the This American Life appearances and just the NPR appearances, has that really grown your audience in a way that you wanted to
I think Bob and Tom probably helped a lot too.
Yeah, both of those are huge.
And they're just opposite ends of the spectrum.
They are. Yeah, yeah. They're very different, but...
Not many people do both.
Both excellent in their own ways. Yeah, I think I'm the one. I think I'm the only one who's straddled those two.
I love Bob and Tom. They are such fucking great guys and brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
They're brilliant in their strategy. Bob and Tom are these guys. They're based out of Indianapolis, and they're syndicated in about 200 markets. And they basically figured out this formula that you could kind of go into these redneck towns and dominate radio there, you know, that didn't really have anything else. And so they have comics on, and they let comics be funny, and they're very generous to the comics. And
not only that, I mean, over the years, I think sometimes they get the reputation. I think Stern's made fun of them for this before, which is I haven't heard, but I've just heard other people say that he has. Is that, you know, they just bring on good comics. They're not funny or whatever, and it's like they actually are really funny and have tagged a lot of my jokes on the air, and I'm like, can I use that? You know?
Well, and not only that, but it takes a comedy savvy person to know like how long to let a comic go on and figure out the beats, and then like you could say the same thing about Stern, like, well, he just has whores on.
Yeah, totally.
He just has whores and midgets on, and they shit onto things.
Yeah, exactly.
So I mean, I don't know if that's really a fair comparison. I mean, I love Stern, but I think Bob and Tom have done a tremendous service to, you know, comedians, particularly if you tour in the Midwest at all.
Yeah, no, that Bob and Tom and This American Life have both been just such a huge help for bringing people who, for people who, my goal has always been like to do shows where people are coming to see me on purpose.
Yes.
Because if you're just part of the comedy show, I mean, I've heard this point made by a lot of people, most recently, like Marc Maron made this point. It's like, there's no kind of thing where you go, tonight it's music night.
Yep.
You know, it's like there are many types of music. It could be death metal or classical.
Yeah, people don't understand.
They don't get that.
Don't understand.
Yeah, comedy's really grouped together.
And so people often go to comedy clubs. And you know, when I was starting out and I started headlining clubs, you know, often people were very disappointed that I would be the main event. and they would kind of go like, you know, you're talking too slow. You're too quiet. You're not.
Yeah, it's your problem.
Yeah. You're not like energetic enough. And I'm like, you know, a lot of this is on purpose. I'm like doing this on purpose. It's kind of my thing. Like this is what I mean, my thing with comedy is I've always like, as an audience member, because I love going to stand-up comedy shows, as an audience member, I just like to not feel pressure from the comedian to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
I hate that when you go to a show and you can feel the comedian being tense
right
on stage. Like, I gotta get this laugh.
Yeah,
but then
right.
There are certain people who just, you know, set you at ease. You know, like Mitch Hedberg, I thought was amazing at that, where he was just so kind of his own thing, and because he was so comfortable in his own skin as this mm-hmm. completely unique being, you know, that you were just like, this is awesome, like I'm just lucky to be here.
I've always had this idea that good comics relate to an audience, but great comics draw the audience in to relate to them, and he was definitely one of those guys. Definitely one of those guys.
That's a good way to put it.
But you do that too. I mean, like, you know, you draw people in as well. Yeah. But I know, like, I was just in Florida this past weekend performing for mostly not my crowd. And but you know, for the most part, the shows were going well.
Mm-hmm.
But one show just wasn't great. Wasn't terrible.
Yeah.
But just wasn't great. There were three bachelorette parties.
I've had that show before.
Like, the energy was scattered, but I thought it was going okay. Like,
yeah.
I was just going to chalk it up as like, eh, this is just one of those ones you get through.
Yeah.
And this big fat guy at the back of the room just goes, he shouts out. This hasn't happened in a long time. He shouts out, "Why don't you tell a funny story?"
Oh my God.
And something in me just kind of snapped. And when I look back and I'm like, that was really stupid what I said, immediately I go, one time, this big piece of shit at the back of the room interrupted my set until security dragged him out and threw him on his ass. And then it's the second it came out of my mouth, I was like, that was really dumb. I don't know why I said that, but the guy like loved it.
Yeah,
that guy involved him. And
nice.
That is awesome.
A good story.
And he really was a big piece of shit.
Yeah, I had it was in Tampa.
It was in Fort Lauderdale.
Oh,
it was.
I had some terrible shows in Tampa. People are always writing me emails like, "Why don't you come to Florida? Why don't you come to Florida?" Then I go to Florida, and they're like, "Maybe you shouldn't come to Florida so much." There's something about me in that state, and also Texas, that's like very precarious.
Except Austin, I'm sure.
Austin's great, and Dallas is great, and people tell me that Houston's great, but a long time ago, I had kind of general comedy show nights that were not great in Houston.
Yeah, I opened for Bill Burr at the Houston Improv several years ago, and I didn't find it to be incredible. But, you know, again, I don't know if I was performing for my crowd. I was not as good of a comic back then. Actually, I was doing shows with Firm in there. We opened as Hard and Firm. So it really didn't score big. But
that's, you know, sometimes you never know though, because they could be there for Bill Burr, and you know, it's like a ska band opening up for Slayer.
Oh, Bill's another one of those guys that you just watch him, and it's like watching a fucking conductor in front of an orchestra. Like he's
incredible. Yeah,
yeah. It seems like he wills the laughs to happen. You really get the idea that he's in control, and he could just, it's like, I don't want you to laugh here, but I'm going to want you to laugh here. Yeah. Just for a little bit, though, so I can get this punchline out.
Not only that, but he and Geraldo are in that same sort of group of guys who would, and Louis C.K. is another guy, too. They're guys that anyone less skilled with the kind of stuff that they're saying and taking on would totally turn an audience against them. Yeah. But they manage to... Yeah. They managed to just kind of like grab the audience by the throat and be like, no, fuck, you know, you're going to fucking take this.
Yeah, no.
And the audience does. Like, you watch the audience become subservient to them. It's fascinating.
Yeah, Bill is so good at taking something, at just challenging the audience to laugh at something that is so beyond the pale. You're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm laughing at this bit.
Up in Montreal, so well written. Up in Montreal, the one bit that he was doing was about like...
Oh, the Rihanna bit.
Yeah, that one made me cringe. He's like, you know, you say there's never a reason to hit a woman. Sometimes there's a reason.
I know.
You can just feel the audience's assholes just go like,
oh, yeah.
But he fucking...
That whole thing
he turned it around. He totally...
Yeah, that bit he has is so funny about, you know, how he was watching Oprah and she goes... The hardest job is to be a mother. And he's like, really? Yes. The hardest job is to be a mother? He's like, there's guys putting out fires in oil fields in Iraq. Do you think being a mother, do you think that guy would want to be a mother? Or do you not think he'd want his job?
I wasn't even thinking the comparison was something about like ice road truckers versus I had to make oatmeal or something.
I had to turn on a Teletubbies video or whatever. I mean, it's just like again we're paraphrasing.
We don't want to butcher people's
brilliant bits, but holy cow, he just turns stuff on its head in such a good way.
Do you find that when you look back at kind of the body of your work, do you see an arc? You know, like do you feel the growth? Are you writing deeper than you used to, or have you seen your writing change in the last?
I'm trying to, you know, and. You know, part of that is working with people who are great, like, you know, Seth, and I work with my brother Joe a lot, and working with Ira Glass is incredible, like, on those pieces for This American Life. Mm-hmm. He just does this thing that, where we're talking through a story, and he just digs deeper, like, what's under that, you know, and what's under that, and what's under that, and I find myself, and actually the whole book of Sleepwalk With Me and Other Painfully True Stories is really a collection of stories where it's all stories that I was not comfortable saying out loud.
That was a turning point. Like, didn't you? Wasn't it like you just kind of brought your journal on stage and started reading from it, and you're like, oh, I didn't realize this was supposed to be funny.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was like after Two Drink Mike came out, which was like 2006. I was on tour. I did a Comedy Central live college tour called the Medium Man on Campus tour, as opposed to the Big Man on Campus, the medium-sized man. And actually, Geraldo did some dates as a special guest on that tour. What I was finding was that when you put out an album, and I didn't anticipate this at all, is that all your fans from that point on know those jokes. And they don't want to hear them. Or some of them do, but maybe in an encore, but they don't want that to be the show because they know that show. And so there was definitely kind of diminishing returns on this material that I had honed for years and years and years. And that was when I started putting on stage, like, you know, stories I had written in my blog, on my Secret Public Journal, which is my blog, and stories that I had written in the Sleepwalk With Me show, which I had written as a one-man show, and I never thought it would work in a stand-up comedy setting. Mm-hmm. But I actually found when I put those stories on stage that they'd have legs pretty fast, you know, because not because they were carefully written jokes, because they weren't, but because I think that ultimately people want to hear stuff that's close to your heart and stuff that's real. And I think that and I would improvise. A lot of times it would be like you tell a story, and then it's like, because you're trying to live for the next laugh, you just find a punchline.
Right. Yeah,
yeah. You know, it's just like I'm telling the story about, having a tumor in my bladder when I was 19, and you're like, well, I got to find a joke in here. And, I had a joke in that story, which is like, I had a tumor in my bladder when I was 19, but it's funny because I'm a hypochondriac, and I think the funniest thing that can happen to a hypochondriac is that you get cancer, because it confirms every fear you've ever had in your entire life. You're like, see? I told you. Remember last week when I was overtired and I thought I had rickets? I was probably right about that, too. There's going to be a lot of changes around here, A lot of that stuff was I would be on stage and you're talking about cancer on stage, and everybody knows someone who's had cancer,
right?
And it ain't funny,
right?
And so you're like, I gotta make this funny fast,
right?
And I think that's I've heard this talked about a lot, but my wife told me they were talking about this on The View the other day, is that a lot of comedians, they were either people who had to make things funny at home because things weren't always so funny at home, or they had to entertain one of their parents who maybe wasn't as happy, or that kind of thing. And I think that comedians, we're often kind of working on our feet and just go, how do I make this funny fast?
Yeah.
And I think that's what I've been striving to do in the last few years, is like, What's the least funny, least comfortable thing for me to talk about?
That's a really great approach. I never thought about that before. Because I feel like with my own writing, I'm kind of going through a point where I'm kind of getting tired. Like, I have this chunk that I've been doing for a while, and I feel like it's about other things, and a lot of it's not really about what me, really.
Yeah.
And so, but you're a great example of someone who's figured out how to go inward, like, rather than, I'm going to write about what's out there, as opposed to, like, nah, I gotta go subterranean and go down. What do you do when you, when you're kind of in writing mode, and then you just hit that wall where your brain just feels like there's a rock in front of your brain and you can't. Do you take a break, or do you?
Oh, you mean every day?
Every waking moment.
You mean the morning time it happens, the afternoon, or the nighttime version? Which one do you want me to speak to?
Do you literally just write stuff anyway and go, this is probably terrible, but at least I'm writing? Or do you?
I really try. Myself, I it's like, you know how when you're a kid and you write on yellow paper in school, and then eventually you get to write on white paper, and you're like,
promotion,
white paper's huge, you can't fuck up white paper is forever. But you really do think when you're a kid, white paper is forever.
Those fat ruled, like, that dash line in the middle is gone, like the training wheels are off.
And you even have to do your own margin with a pencil.
You have
the ruler and the pencil. And
it's not fucking kindergarten anymore.
No. It's going to be in a time capsule at the Smithsonian.
Exactly. You have to put your name and class number on the other side, smaller, on your own.
Yeah. There's a format.
Just so you know, the poem you're writing about rabbits is going to be at the Smithsonian because it's on white paper. Yeah.
Hurry up, because we got to encase it in glass.
So someday in the future they can go, apparently these rabbits enjoy carrots.
a lot of times I have to, and I really think being a comedian, particularly starting out, but in my case still, is about deluding yourself and telling yourself something is going well when it's really not going well, because otherwise you wouldn't get on stage again. You'd just be like, I guess human beings don't like me.
Right.
Because it's not like a play or a movie where if people don't like it, they can go, well, we didn't like the set or the costumes. With stand-up comedy, if people don't like it, they're basically saying, we don't like you.
Right.
Your personality.
Right.
And
who you are, what you say.
Yeah, yeah.
The timbre of your voice.
This whole thing.
Oh, that's a bad combo.
This whole thing isn't working for me. And that's a hard reality to face, and that's why I think comedians in some ways are a little delusional and a little bit ill. because we have to just go back up and fail.
It's a weird thing to keep doing.
But everything's great. What are you talking about? Everything's fine.
Yeah, and so I think that in order for me to write as much as I do, this is so funny because I'm writing a screenplay right now, and I'm probably 20 drafts in. You know, it's like so many drafts. I've been working on it for a year and a half.
Jonah just grimaced like, oh my god, 20 drafts.
20 drafts, give up.
And I still have the convincing myself it's yellow paper. I save, every time I'm starting a new draft, my save as is Sleepwalk With Me Experiment. Experiment.
20 drafts
experiment.
In.
Experiment.
That's very scientific, though. That's very scientific of you.
Yeah, and I still do it. I did it yesterday on the airplane. I'm 20 drafts in. I wrote Experiment.
Maybe this thing will work out. Let's roll the dice and write 20 drafts.
And then what I do is I tell myself that if the experiment doesn't work, then we'll go back to the last draft.
Right.
You know. So, yeah, I still do it. That's my yellow paper.
That's incredible. So Sleepwalk With Me is out now. Or is it coming out?
Sleepwalk With Me and Other Painfully True Stories comes out in stores October 12th, which is a Tuesday, and it's on Amazon pre-order now, which if you really like me, do that, because then that'll make it be popular.
Truthfully, I think people who listen to this podcast are more inclined to buy it on Amazon anyway.
Yeah.
They don't like the out-of-doors.
They don't like to go out-of-doors go into brick-and-mortar environments.
Yeah. I got nothing.
Well, I would love to have. So these shows, by the time this goes up, which will be in about a week and a half.
Actually, when it comes out.
Actually, it'll be perfect. This will go up the day before your book comes out.
Oh, great.
So this actually works out pretty well.
Great.
But you're in LA doing some shows at the UCB Theater.
That's right. Well, yeah, but I'm.
So those will have already
happened. Those will have happened, but I'm doing one at the Avalon. They were great.
You're doing a show at the Avalon?
I killed. I'm doing a show at the Avalon, which is, I believe, October 21.
Oh, that's
in
great.
In Los Angeles, yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So the UCB shows were destroyed. And they carried you out and threw you into
God.
A pile of treasure and pussy.
I killed so hard tonight and tomorrow.
Yeah.
Everyone at Birds was talking about it.
Do you like to talk to the crowd a lot? Like, were you ever interactive with the crowd when you were doing clubs?
When I do theaters, no.
You can't, really.
You can't.
Yeah.
You can't. Because it's completely lost on the rest of the audience. And people who try to talk to the audience learn that. The hard way. And I probably
people sitting up in the balcony can't see the one guy's shirt that you're making fun of.
Yeah, those early Spalding Gray audience interactions were not good.
Yeah,
I'm just gonna do some crowd work.
The audience is not mic'd, so what he said is you're a douchebag, and then what I said was no, you're a douchebag.
Recapping,
I see that sometimes when a guy does a crowd work, and it's just like, what do you do? And you know, the person in the front row says, I work at a bank. It's like, really? And then it's just no one else can hear this. Like, they're not.
I've
seen that happen a bunch.
But you know, when I pretty much get my shows ready in clubs to bring to the theaters. I think theaters are the white paper.
Yeah.
And clubs are the yellow paper in a lot of ways. And I do interact with the crowds, particularly, I don't go, where are you from? What do you do? Mm-hmm. It's more like, if I say something, like in my last one-man show, you know, I have a story that is very compromising where I'm clearly in the wrong, where I'm, like, you know, cheating on my ex-girlfriend. And I'm not saying in, like, I'm cheating on my ex-girlfriend. No, it was like a low point, and I'm trying to get that across, you know, a lot of times people, when I was workshopping, I would go, ooh, you know, and then what I would do, and it was actually really helpful, is when I had a very vocal response like that, I would just be like, what do you mean by that? Like, when you say, ooh, like, are you, like, upset? Are you mad at me? Or do you understand that it's, like, a human mistake and a thing that we're all humans? And they'll respond, you know, and we'll kind of talk through
it. What do they say? Because I always feel like people listen to about every fourth word, and then they hear some buzzword, and it's not in context, and then they just go, "Ooh, you shouldn't have said that." And you're like, yeah. "But you're not really paying attention. So what did they say?"
Yeah, I mean, like, my audience is I like a lot, and I find that they're pretty, you know, they're pretty lucid, and they'd be like, you know, that's just not funny, you know? And I'm like, I know, but it's part of a larger story I'm trying to tell. And, you know, and we would really have a conversation, you know, like, it's important for you guys to know that part of the story, because I'm trying to explain sort of how, like, the mindset that I was in this part of my life. And it's important for context. And they'd be like, "Oh, it's just, I just don't," they'll be like, "I just don't think of you that way. Like, I don't want to," you know, and so, yeah.
I think the more I think about it, it feels like a comedy show is really a place where, like, it's like a safe room. Like, the audience wants to feel safe.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of times, you know, like, some comics will get by on just kind of referencing things without really kind of jokes.
Just remember Pogs.
Remember Pogs, or remember Funyuns, or whatever.
Yeah.
And then people laugh, but I think in laughter there's kind of a it's like a release of tension where,
oh, absolutely,
they hear something they recognize, and they're like, "Oh, that's in my brain too. We're all in the same tribe. Everything's okay.
Yeah.
I'm safe."
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, those moments where people are like, "Ooh," it's almost like you're stepping outside their safety zone for a sec. But that's great that you actually have a conversation with them, because then you can pull them back in and be like, "No, come on, kids. Let's all crowd around and fuck it out. Everything's gonna be fine. You're safe.
Come on, get back on the carpet."
And it helps a lot. It helps a lot because I can identify what's the part that is making them feel alienated, mm-hmm. and what's the part that they can identify with. Because I think often, like, as comedians, we kind of go towards the stuff that just kills in this really broad way. Like, I'm writing my new show right now, and I was writing this joke, and a lot of it was, like, riffing, but it was, like, you know, about how it was about, like, the simplicity of sex for men, and how men and women have a very different relationship with sex. And a lot of times when I say this with my female friends, they'll be like, we like sex just as much as you do. And I'm like, yeah, but it's different. And they're like, how? And I'm like, have you ever masturbated while driving a car? And, like, I want you to think about that, and then I want you to, you know, talk to your closest male friend, and I want you to compare answers. And, like, that was a joke that I really liked. But then I had, like, this other riff about how, like, you know, like, because, like, it, like, with, like, it's a real, sex is a real knee-jerk thing for men, where, like, it, you know, if you ask a guy to have sex, they'll just be like, yeah, you know, of course, you know, And then women will be like, you know, and, you know, I'm really interested in having this necklace. And they'll be like, yeah, I'll get you that. Like, I have a job. I have, like, a job. And they give me money at this job so that I can do that. And then we'll have sex. When are we going to have sex? Like, soon. Like, when can we make this happen? And, like, and, you know, my wife actually kind of, and some friends of mine kind of pulled me back on the second part of that, like the part about men having a knee-jerk reaction to sex, and they'll have sex whenever, wherever, because, you know, a few of my friends were pointing out, like, that's not actually entirely accurate to the male and female experience, that for a lot of women they actually get frustrated in the other direction, that in fact, you know, in relationships, they've wanted to be the person who wants to have sex all the time, and they feel shunned because the male doesn't want to have sex, mm-hmm. and they feel like it's a reflection on them, or, you know. And so I really kind of, in my new show, I really go through the bits, and I try to make sure that nothing I'm saying is actually, you know, I don't know how you describe it, but, like, and it, like, I try not to have anything be emotionally dishonest.
Right.
But I think like the masturbating while driving a car thing, for me, that passes the smell test.
Yeah.
Because the audience is just like completely goes nuts when I tell it. And it really is split down the middle. And I've talked extensively. This is how sad a comedian's job is. I've spoken extensively with both men and women about masturbating while driving a car. And overwhelmingly, I've found that men have masturbated while driving a car much more often than women. Much more. Let's throw it around here.
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
Three for three.
No, yeah. Sometimes you drive by a chick and she's in another car and you're like, is she down there playing the washboard? But ultimately,
she's digging through her purse between her legs, you know? That's what they do, looking for a lipstick.
Yeah, a little lipstick. But ultimately, I think what we can derive from this is that, Mike Birbiglia, you are a comedy scientist. I put all the pieces together. You work like a scientist. You do research like a scientist. You tirelessly edit and re-edit like a scientist. And you even call your drafts experiments. You are a comedy scientist.
I even call my drafts experiments. That's a really good thesis.
You are a comedy scientist. You if you had a lab coat on, I would be like, that's it. Yes. I get it.
I think we've got a new character. Saves persona.
Yeah. That would be, if I were an 80s comedian, I would have, you know, the lab coat on.
Vaguely Doc Brown hair. Yeah, Dr. Mike. Sleeves.
Yeah. No, it's funny because it's like, it just so happens that the comedy scientist would be the worst actual scientist imaginable. I mean, talk about like the worst science student in the world. I mean, I was just off. I almost failed high school chemistry. I remember that.
You don't need it.
Yeah, I don't need that crap. No, I guess that's right. I don't think of it as science as much as like sociologist or like a anthropologist. You're just like trying to understand people, you know, and trends and how people think. And psychology, I guess, is the other one. You try and think through how people make decisions.
Understanding people and then being able to digest that and then spit it out so other people can understand those other people.
Yeah.
Well, we're at the we're kind of at the end of the hour, and I don't want to keep you, but this has been a fantastic chat.
Yeah, this is great.
So much fun.
This is great.
It's kind of what
so
I like
much.
About like being able to talk for an hour is that you really sort of get a sense of someone's brain, which is really fun. And I can see two copies of Sleepwalk With Me and Other Painfully True Stories, which by the time this comes out will be available Tuesday, October 12th.
What's ridiculous about this is that this... I'm sorry. This is my copy, and I'm not done.
You've been looking at my copy.
Yeah, yeah. I have crossouts, and I have a hard copy, and people see this in stores. I literally have, like, you know, editing carrots and crossouts, and I'm still editing... different parts of the book, and it's never gonna be reprinted. I mean, there's no one's ever gonna make these changes. It's just that I can't stop, which happens to be one of the chapters of the book.
The charming thing is like year after year, you just self release another copy that's like, but this copy is
abridged, abridged.
I can't stop. Page 111 is one of the chapter titles. Wow.
It should have been the longest chapter.
I think I can't stop because I don't feel qualified to be in comedy, and I feel like I have to just overachieve and maybe.
Well,
if
that's your process, that's fine. But you're pretty well qualified to be in comedy at this point.
Thanks for saying so.
Let's just read the book here. Let's just make the audio version right now. Chapter one.
I don't like this word, so I'll replace this word with another word. Cool, man. So online, where is it? Just MikeBirbiglia.com?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
MikeBirbiglia.com. Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, thanks so much for having us up to your swanky entourage style W hotel room.
Oh God. Yeah,
yeah, bro.
Sorry. Hey, bro. You want to go down to get some mimosas? Look at some tail.
I don't know. He's on his way. Johnny, you got to get to this.
Blah blah blah. Turtle. The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.